I'm going to be speaking at a higher rate of speed today, or I'm going to try it. I'm not used to this, but I'm going to try it for a couple of reasons, and I'm not going to reveal them until later on in the lecture. Now, the subject today I call noises and voices, or the art of listening. Now, this subject, as many subjects that I will be discussing during the next 2 weeks, are ones that are either of special interest to me or they are very disturbing to me. And this one probably comes under the heading of very disturbing to me. I have not actually performed research in this area, but I've done a lot of collection of information in this area, and this is what I'm going to impart to you today. Before we begin, I'd like to read a few things from Scripture. From the Psalms, "They have ears, but do not hear." From Isaiah, "His ears are open, but he does not hear." From Jeremiah, "But your fathers did not listen to me or incline their ears to me." In Matthew, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." And this appears many times in the Bible. Blessed are, and from, this is also Matthew, "Blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear." And in Mark, "If any man has ears to hear, let him hear." And he said to them, "Take heed what you hear. The measure you give will be the measure you get, and still more will be given you." And then, as is my custom, I also read from George MacDonald, "We are often unable to tell people what they need to know because they want to know something else." Now, I said that this was disturbing to me.
That comes first.
Now, I am interested in this subject, and some of you can look at me and say, "Well, because when you have ears like mine, and you're only about one-fifth as big as mine, and you still have ears like this, you know, they become a problem to you because they're so big." And so ears have been of some concern to me because mine are unusually big. And also, I'm quite sensitive to noise. I'm a very light sleeper. So noise has been a problem to me. And my wife and I, on our discussions that we do have more frequently now than before, because I've become interested in listening, she told me one time in a discussion that if she had to lose either her hearing or her sight, she would choose to lose her sight or choose to keep her hearing. And this was quite surprising to me. The other reason is that people don't use their ears. Now, this will become evident, I think, as we proceed. My associates, I give them instructions, and they don't follow them. My wife says that I do not hear her. I tell her she didn't hear me. My children say that I don't listen to them. I give some sterling lectures to the professional students, and then I test them with a very intensive but just examination. And it's as if many of them had not been there. And maybe some of them weren't, but maybe some of this is not so much in their hearing, and I'll admit this, but in the person who is saying this. Now, another area that I've been interested in, and that's where we're going to start, is on noises. I have for a long time been interested and wondered, did the ancients know something about noise that we didn't know? Had they captured this mystery of noise to utilize it, as we are beginning to utilize it now? Were they able to perform some of those great feats that they did with noise? I don't know this, and this was a strange fascination to me. So we're going to begin with noise. But before we begin with noise, I have to show you this lovely drawing of the ear. Because when we talk about hearing and noise, we must talk a little bit about the ear. And an associate of mine drew this lovely ear. All of you can't hear see it, but you can, if you're interested, look in it afterwards. And I'll point out just a few features of it. Much of it you probably already knew. There are many things, I should say, however, about the ear that we still do not know. It is a most remarkable organ, and we were a long time in even getting to where we are now. A Hungarian named von Bekesi, who was at Harvard, well, he was in Hungary, came to Harvard, and then I think he's in Hawaii now, and I think somebody else is trying to buy him off now. But he was very interested in the ear, and he made a model of the ear, a mechanical model, and he devised a system which I will not go into. And at the time of the war, and this is how some things go, and I always have to get some experimental animal in here, to be true to my profession. And they were in need of food, so they decided to kill the elephant at the zoo, and that's a lot of meat in an elephant. And on hearing this, he said to his associate, "You run right down there, and as soon as they kill the elephant, you cut out his ear and bring it back, its entirety. And then we'll check out my mechanical principle." And the ear of an elephant is not only large, but it's also very efficient. Hears exceedingly well. This is not always true if you have a big ear that you hear well, but I have been told. But the elephant's ear does work very well. Now, as the elephant and man, we have the outer ear, the external meatus, or the ear. It funnels in the sound waves to the tympanic membrane or the eardrum, and that's connected to something that we all learned. They call it something else, but the hammer, the anvil, and the stirrup still obtains. You can call it something else, but there's some, and they operate in a cavity filled with air, and something called a manubrium is attached to, I suppose, to the hammer, and when the sound comes in, there's a distortion of the eardrum, and this is converted through the hammer and anvil staple into the inner ear. These three bones that I've just mentioned are in the middle ear. They transmit to the inner ear, and this is a great source of much difficulty to us. Not only because we don't fully understand it, but because there's many things you can't do in there, although there have been some remarkable things that have been performed in regards to operations in this area. But this is the seat of sort of the conversion of the sound waves for transmission to the brain to tell us what we are hearing, and also it is the seat for our balance. And if any of you have ever had difficulty in this, you'll know this is a very frightening thing. I've had labyrinthitis, and I hope none of you ever have it. It's absolutely awful. I should say that there's also a communication from the middle ear to the throat, to the nasopharynx. This is usually closed, except when you yawn, when you chew, and for other reasons. And sometimes this gets stopped up when you have a cold and stuff, and you're very uncomfortable, or when you're flying, and you don't swallow enough or yawn enough or eat enough while you're flying, you feel like you're filled up. I think that's enough for that because we have much to cover. And so we'll then proceed to noise. Now, the first thing I guess I should tell you is that how fast does it go? We're always interested in a few facts, I guess. In air, sound travels about 1,100 feet per second. If you take it to water, it'll travel about five times as fast. And to give you an illustration here, 50 pounds of dynamite can be heard about 10 miles through the air and about 10,000 miles in water. So there's quite a difference. So I guess maybe if you could, it'd be interesting to listen to a concert, you know, underwater sometime. It might be a strange, I have never tried that. But we used to, when we were swimming, you know, you go underwater and you hit some rocks underwater, you know. Used to be a game we played. In steel, it travels 15 times as fast as it does in air. Now, I have mentioned here that noise, as the nature of noise or its characteristics, we have to speak of frequency and intensity. And we'll start with frequency because that's more simple. And that's sort of the number of waves that pass a certain point in unit time. and we speak of this in cycles per second usually, and this is pitch. And we can hear, I believe, maybe down as low as 15 cycles up to 20,000 cycles. That some of us can, or some of you can. I can't hear that well because I'm getting older. My range is probably down near 10,000. It's really a little better than this because I've had it tested, but I had some of my high tones knocked out in a war from concussion. So, and also I'm getting older, so I'm not as efficient. I cannot detect the higher pitches. But that's all right, because most of our music is below 10,000. The lowest point or cycles per second on the organ is probably about 16, piano about 27. A singer might hit 80 at a low point when you're singing Old Man River. A soprano may go up to 1,200, a piccolo over 4,000. And if you use a one-inch pipe on an organ, you might go up to 8,000. The standard, the international standard, is about 440 cycles per second, although many orchestras prefer to go to 441 or 442. There are about 25 people per million who have perfect pitch. In other words, you say, hit 400 cycles per second, and they'll hit 400 cycles per second. They remember it just like I remember my wife's name or my child's name. Or maybe I shouldn't say that because they're laughing because I sometimes call them something else. I mix them up. That isn't a good one. But you get the idea. I mean, some people do have perfect pitch, and we do not fully understand why. Dogs, bats, porpoises, and such creatures as that might detect up to 150,000 cycles per second. And that's why, I mean, you can disturb a dog or call a dog with a whistle you can't hear. And of course, these sound waves have been utilized in many ways, but I can't go into that, although it's a very interesting subject. Now let us proceed to loudness, or intensity. Intensity and loudness, for our purposes here, are similar, and we measure this in decibels. Now these are hard to talk about because they're on a log scale. And for every 10 decibel increase, you go up by a tenfold multiplication. In other words, if you have 40 decibels, go to 50, that's a tenfold increase. Or if you go from 40 decibels up to 100 decibels, this is a millionfold, you see. You go up by, you add a zero each time and multiply by it. Now, what can we hear? What is one decibel? I think the best expression of this is this is the sound made by a baby mouse urinating on a blotter at 3 feet distance. 3 feet distance. This is one decibel. Now, there are devices that can record even more sounds than this. We have devices, for example, that can detect a piece of Kleenex hitting the cement 50 feet away. Or there are spy deals that you can go up to a building like this and be listening with the pickup right back of you, and you can hear a conversation maybe on the 10th floor. I mean, there are some unusual devices being developed for this. Ordinary conversation is 60 decibels. Mine is usually a little higher than this. Foghorns may go up to 120 or 130. But you can't stand this too long. In fact, if you listen to this, if you're really hit with this for too long, there may be temperature changes or permanent deafness. You may also have blurred vision. Louder noises than this have been devised. In the early 50s, there was a professor at Penn State who built a siren capable of 175 decibels. Now, this is about 10,000 times louder than a riveting machine. And if you've ever heard those, I'm pretty soon you sort of go like this, you know. And this device could go from 3,000 cycles per second up to 30-some-thousand cycles per second. Now, strange things happen when they put things in this field. If they put their hand in it, it started to bleed. It burned. It burned it. They suspended some marbles in this field. They put it up, placed it in the vertical. They put marbles on it, and these marbles floated gently in the air. or he could make a penny sort of act like a ballet line. He put a mouse in it and it killed it within a minute because of overheating. It disintegrated insects in 10 seconds. Though we don't hear so much about this now because there's, of course, extensive extensive secret work underway. There are many large firms who are doing extensive work on sound. Now, what are some of the other uses that sound has been put to? And they are very extensive. I mean, we use it extensively in the laboratory for cleaning or for mixing materials, ultrasonics. There have been, of course, many experiments or several experiments on its utilization to control populations or to disorient them. And one can disorient them. And of course, whenever we have an instrument like this, say, well, will it work in war? And it has, in fact, been tried for this. The Germans tried it. They experimented with the Jews on this. They used some extensive noise makers. About all they ever were able to do, however, was to produce a bunch of deaf Jews. Now, you can also, there are certain, the devices will resonate. There are certain resonant frequencies for objects or even parts of people. For example, if you take a banjo and you put it by a piano and hit the A string, the A string on the, or hit A, I think, in the, is there an A string on a banjo? It'll sing, you see. It will sing. And then a Columbia professor experimented with this, and he used massive sound at about 75 cycles per second. And he put these students in his room and started to hit them with this 75 cycles per second. But it wasn't very long before half of them had gone out the room. The reason for this is that 75 cycles per second is near the resonance frequency of the anal sphincter. And this, of course, has been experimented with to an extent, and thought, wouldn't this be a good way to control mobs, or even as an instrument of war? And in fact, there has been some work on this. Another use for it, you can attract girls with it. At the Newport Jazz Festival, a person came in there, sort of observing the thing, and he noticed a very strange thing. There was a girl who was lying up by the bass fiddler with her ear down on the floor. And he went up to her and he says, "For Pete's sake, what are you doing?" And she says, "Boy, I'm getting something through this floor that really turns me on from this bass fiddler." To make a long story short, she married this bass fiddler within a year. So there'll probably be an increase in the market for bass fiddlers, or bass fiddles. It has also been used to drown out pain. A dentist and a sound engineer got together and they said maybe part of this this hesitancy of people going to the dentist is the sound of the drill, and maybe this is very disturbing to them. So maybe we can fix a device where the victim can sit there and he can turn on various sounds. He can turn on white sound, which essentially, by white sound we mean something that blots out the sound that's prevalent. So he can turn on white sound, or he can turn on tape music of various types, and he can turn it on as loud as he wants. And they found that you could, utilizing this device, they wouldn't have to use anesthesia. They could pull a person's teeth, and he'd be turning the thing way up, and it would sort of block out. Noises then can be used as an analgesic. I have not observed this myself, but my reading indicates that it has been utilized more extensively, in fact, than I had thought. Now, noises can also drive people sort of crazy. I mean, you can just stand so much of it. Like the fellow in New York one day, I mean, all this noise, and New York, many cities keep getting noisier. And he got to the breaking point one morning when the garbage man was down there sort of pounding things. And he jumped out of bed and he went down there and he grabbed the garbage man, picked him up and threw him headfirst into the garbage. I mean, it just got too much for him. He says, "I'm going to make this place quiet." And of course, it can drive people nuts if you can keep people from sleeping. I mean, the Chinese found this out in the sort of brainwashing. I mean, if you just keep people from sleeping, or if you interrupt their sleep, You have to dream a certain amount, you see, to still stay sane, or as sane as we are, relatively sane, I guess. There was an interesting experiment on animals. I'll depart from the unprepared text here for this. They wondered, and this is how psychologists sort of get led down the criminal's path. They suspended a rat by its tail, and when you do that, the rat will scream, a sort of bloody murder. And then they taught some rats that they could shut this off. If they pressed a lever, it would release this rat, so he quit screaming. And it says, an altruistic rat, you know? But then somebody else ran the experiment, and then they put in another lever, which instead of, they could also press this lever to let the rat down, but they could press this other lever, which would create white noise, which would shut the screaming rat off. What did they do? They went over and pressed the rat for the white noise. I mean, the lever for the white noise, you see. They were not altruistic. They were like people, you see. Industry is concerned about this. I mean, you always see this service because some people have to make money this way, but I think it's probably true because noise is very disturbing and it does affect efficiency. One person estimated that our loss in efficiency in industry is, what, $2 million a day? Huh? Probably worse than that some places. I think that's enough for noise, because there's another dimension that I want to talk about. So we'll go on down to voice. and sort of this art of listening. Now, there has been a considerable amount of activity in this area in the last decade. Up to that time, people were most concerned about reading and writing as far as the communication disciplines go. A Professor Hubble said that 98% of all that we learn through our eyes and ears. A man at Ohio State named Parker made a study on communication because he wondered how much of a day is spent in communication. So he obtained the services of 60 white-collar workers. And he wanted them to log their activity over a period of a couple of months. I know in industry, when I was in industry, we did this sometimes. We'd keep a diary of how we used our time. Well, that's what these people did. Well, they did it at every 15 minutes. So I don't know if they got anything else done. But he said that these 60 or 65 people performed very well in this. And the study has been repeated with, I think, sort of comparable results. Now, this is, of course, a segment of our population that isn't the entire population. But he found out some startling things. He found out that 70% of their day was spent in communication. Now, he broke this down, and he found that 9% of this time in communication was spent in writing. 16% was spent in reading. 30% was spent in speaking, and 45% in listening. Now, you and I know some people that it's quite a bit different. They talk most of the time. But when you examine, then, our curriculum in our schools, it isn't quite like this. Up till 10 years ago, and now, from here on, much of what I'm going to tell you is based on the work of Professor Nichols at the University of Minnesota, who's made an extensive study of this. And he became very concerned about this, and so he took a sabbatical leave to study this. And he found out that at 10 years ago, or 15, well, in the early 50s, there was nothing that he could detect in the high schools that was directed at this art of listening. He found, of course, that a person would spend 16 years, probably in school, learning how to write. And I might say they were usually unsuccessful on teaching them how to write a sentence or even a good paragraph, but they did spend this time at it. They spent 8 years in learning how to corrective reading. As far as speaking, well, up until very recently, we had a few plays, and now and then we'd have a speech class, I never had any speech classes, and you probably figured this out. But until I think my last year in college or something. And but we had a few plays, but and we had a debate team, maybe. Our school was too small for a debate team, but who goes to the debate team? A few pastor's sons and a couple lawyer's sons. I mean, they're the ones that do it. So that's how it goes. We didn't learn how to speak, and there was nothing on listening. There was one college about 15 years ago that was teaching something that could be considered listening. It was Stevens College down in Missouri. It's a women's college. Sort of to give them all the social graces, they thought they ought to be able to listen. And at that time, Dr. Nichols made a survey. He looked at the literature that was coming out, that is, the technical literature, on this general subject of research. There were 3,000 papers that were pretty good in the area of reading. There was one that could probably be cited as having to do with listening. Now, he thought it was more important than this. And other people also became very concerned. And I might say at this point that in the last decade, there's been great activity in this. You can teach listening now. Somebody here, Karen by name, she's involved in this in her first or second grade, she told me. Colleges are teaching it. The Army is, and the Navy and the Air Force, they have training films on listening, and they have special courses on listening. Some of the activities that have been going on in this, we can turn to some of the work in the universities. Harvey Jones at Columbia, he was very dismayed when he was responsible for, 400 and some college freshmen in psychology. And he'd bring them in, he'd give them what he thought was a very good lecture, and then he'd test them to see what is the retention. And he was always dismayed at how much they would recall. So then he ran an experiment. He interested several of his colleagues who he thought were very good lecturers, and he said, you come in and you give a 10-minute lecture on the subject you like the best. And then he obtained their lectures ahead of time, and he made it what he thought was a comprehensive examination. And so that the lecturer would come in, he'd get his 10-minute lecture, he'd test them. And he found out that their score was generally 50%. And he did another thing. He waited 2 months, and then he tested them again. And their retention was only 25%. Well, Nichols could hardly believe this. He says, this can't be. So he essentially ran the same experiment at the University of Minnesota. He gave a 10-minute talk, and then he'd test them. And he thought he gave a very good test, but he found essentially the same thing. But he didn't wait 2 months. He waited 2 weeks, and he got the same results. About 25% of what was related was comprehended or retained. He feels that maybe if he'd just waited 2 days, he would have found out the same thing. Now, bad listening must cause a great deal of trouble. I think it must, I know it concerns industry, because I was in industry, and I'm sure Paul has been involved in things like this. Because industry, on many production lines, I think they must run as far as scrap metal and things like this. Their efficiency must be maybe 98% or something, I don't know, depending on how you measure it. Or otherwise, you just can't meet the competition. But you're dealing then in industry and many other businesses where with 98% efficiency in some areas, but in this area of communication, which is so important, you're 25% efficient. There was an interesting study performed by a professor at the University of Louisiana. It's related by Dr. Nichols. This student came to him and he said, I want to do my graduate work under you for my PhD in reading communication. And he says, I want you to do it in listening. And he says, here's your assignment. You put on your good clothes and you go on down to New Orleans and you try to interview as many businessmen as you can. And you ask them, how they like their work, how they think their company is doing, and and you ask them how they feel the workers' morale is, and how their communication system is within their organization. And essentially to a man, he found out this management was very proud of their company. They liked their job. They thought their company was a very good company. They became, they waxed very eloquent when they spoke of their communication system. They thought it was really great. Worker morale, they had loyal employees, outstandingly loyal employees. So he came back following this, and he says, all right, now your next assignment is this. You put on work clothes. You're going to be an assistant truck driver, but a little different than others. You're going to have a notebook in your pocket, and you're going to listen to these people for the next year. You're going to make notes on all these, what the workers say about their companies, because you're going to be traveling around a great deal. After a year, he came back, a whole pile of notebooks, and they spent many weeks going through these. And the results were, well, I think I could have told him what the results would have been. I don't think Professor Nichols should have been excited about this, because I was in industry long enough to know the attacks. It was just the opposite of what management had told them. The attacks by the worker and their regard for management, it was a very vicious thing. It was malicious. They literally hated their guts. They hated their guts. They didn't understand what the company was up to, and little of what the managers were telling them ever got to them. So other people have made studies on this. I know my old company, General Electric, has been very concerned with this. And they have found that whenever you go through the very various levels of management, if you start with the board, and then the chairman of the board calls in the vice president and tells him something, and then he passes it on, say, to a director or a plant manager, and the plant manager goes down to the foreman, and you go through maybe five levels of management, what is your loss? Well, probably 20% of what the chairman of the board says gets to the employee. I mean, this is probably a pretty good batting average. Now, there have been many studies on how one can get around this. I know General Electric Company, they hired, some 70 people one time, and they called them communication experts. They were going to try to correct this thing. We've gone through attitude surveys. I remember when I was there, they had an opinion survey, and then they had attitude surveys, and then they hired psychologists for interviews. They encouraged more of the foreman or the next level of management to go down and talk to the people. They had suggestion boxes, and they were really great, boy. They were really good for some laughs. You'd find everything, including a pistol in them sometimes, like, use this on yourself, you know. They did encourage open forums and things like this, and generally with only varying success. Even in these opinion surveys, I know how they answered them. I've answered opinion surveys. And you try to analyze them now. What are they up to? Can they figure out, really, who is answering? Can they really go into this and say, that's old Busted that's answering that, you see? And I remember when we had an opinion survey one time. And our particular group, we said, tell them what you think, you know? And they did, huh? They tell them what they think. And boy, that plant manager for the next several years, boy, our outfit was the one that he visited the most because there was trouble there. They didn't catch us on the next one. Everything was great. We don't want to see that plant manager around here anymore. Now they've used various gimmicks on this. They thought, well, what we really need is a communication center. Rather than going through all this, we should have one center and where the information can be put in and then put out. And one company, as Dr. Nichols relates, thought they'd get a very beautiful woman who was also a communication expert and sort of a matronly type lady who would be a nurse, who would be sympathetic. And you can guess what happened. I mean, they lined up, you know. They lined up outside and came in to tell their troubles. They had somebody that would listen to them. But then some rat fink put out the word that this was a sounding board for management. And nobody, they quit lining up outside. A competitor says, everybody knows that we're not structured to have a woman listen. We should have a father image, a father confessor. So they went out and got an old chaplain who was really a great guy. And they set him up in business. And they told the workers, come on in. Tell him your problems. He'll be the focus here for the communication center, and everything will be great. Well, instead of 2 days, this lasted about 4 days, because some rat fink again said, this guy is the lapdog for one of the vice presidents. That was the end of that. Now, with this great inefficiency, what you'd say that if this prevails in industry, they should all be bankrupt, you know? Well, the truth of the matter is, I think over the last 25 years, probably a 95% mortality in businesses. I think the surveys show something like this, about 3% per year. Now, I'm not saying that all of this is due to the lack of the art of listening or communication, but I'm sure some of it is involved in it. Now, Dr. Nichols performed some studies, some further investigations on this, and some studies. But before I give you that, though, I should tell you something else. It's about opinion surveys, sort of. And somebody investigating this says, well, let's put down what the criteria of the important morale-building factors. And we will choose a whole series of these, and then we'll give one set to management and one set to the worker. And we'll find out just how they rate these. And management, on three very significant ones, placed them. And you see, I must admit that I was, in there I could come here, I was a member of management. If I was one step lower, sort of, I would have been in the sheep pen, sort of looking out. So I was sort of a little closer to it. So I think I had some feeling, sort of, for both sides of it. And I'm not sure how I would have answered this, but I think I would have put it differently than some of this management. But they said that number 8 was a full appreciation for work done by the worker, was very important. Number 9, they put, it's important that they be in on things. And number 10, that they have sympathetic help on their personal problems. Now, that's where management put Well, management put these 8, 9, and 10. The worker put them 1, 2, and 3. What was most important to the worker, according to this survey, was appreciation for work done. And in working with many workers, they found, in intensive interviews, what is it, what if you like your boss, what is it you like about him? Well, The two statements they heard the most was, well, he listens to me. He listens to me, or I can talk to him. All right, now, we'll go to some studies, just a few studies by Nichols. And what he did was to break down his class. I think whether it was 100 or 50 in each group, I don't recall, because I probably didn't hear it right, you see. But he divided them into what were the worst listeners, those that apparently weren't hearing him. And then he picked out maybe 50 of the best. And he tried to say, well, what is different in these two groups? What really makes the difference? And he gave them extensive tests. Now, some of you can assault these tests, as I have criticized them. But on reading, comprehension, writing, their intelligence, and personality tests, all kinds of batteries of tests. And he tried to come out with, well, what is it about these good listeners that's different from the bad listeners? Or what are the bad listeners doing? And he came up with about 10 things. Other people have done the same thing, And I guess if you do it the same way, you probably come up with the same answers. Maybe that's what these other studies show. But there are many people who feel this way about it now. And the character, and there are certainly these characteristics now, which I will review very rapidly. The first thing that the bad listener does, or one of the things that the bad listener does, he immediately, on the announcement of the subject, noises and voices, he says, "Oh, for Pete's sake, what do I want to hear this for? I mean, I'm not interested in noises and voices." And so immediately his mind wanders. What he's going to do tomorrow, or what he did yesterday, or why didn't he go fishing, you know? I mean, you escape. On the other hand, the good listener says, he might start with the same way. Well, noises and voices, how can any good come out of this, you know? But then he says, well, I'm challenged here to find out maybe there is something in it I can use, huh? At least that's what his study showed. And he then quotes Chesterton, who says, "There is no such a thing as an uninteresting subject, only uninterested listeners." The second thing that the bad listener did was to immediately criticize the speaker. Huh? I mean, the fellow got up there, took one look at him, and he opened his mouth and says, "Oh, brother." I mean, they might not even wait for him to open his mouth, huh? "Look at that lousy, what's he wearing these old army pants for? I mean, hasn't he worn them out yet? Or is he still think he's in the military, you know? And this coat, look at the cut on his coat. It's a Pendleton jacket. But for Pete's sake, they quit wearing those 10 years ago. Huh?" Or, listen to that voice, huh? Boy, only a mother could love listening to that voice, and look how he looks. Huh? What a funny looking guy. And so they're lost, you know. And he speaks very, he doesn't use good English, you know. But the good listener, he might note the same thing. But he says, maybe something good can come out of it. So it's kind of a challenge then to see, can he really come out of this? And he overlooks the bad English. And analogies often run here. I mean, if somebody came running in here, clad in old clothes, and he says, "All right, you guys, this lousy shack is on fire and you better get out of here, huh?" I mean, we don't say you should couch your language in, or you should couch this in better rhetoric, huh? Zoom, we're out of here, huh? I mean, so that's sort of what how the good listener looks at it. The other thing that the bad listener does, he gets overstimulated. Instead of withholding his evaluation, and it's sort of tied with his first one, he gets all worked up about this, and he really gets wheedled off. And I notice the students, in a professional course I sit through, I give a series of lectures in it, but I sit through essentially the whole course because I want to integrate my lectures into the main thing. And I sit in the back of the room. A lot of them don't know who I am at first. I sit there and listen to them, they're really caustic about this, you know. The first few sentences, I mean, the fellow says they get really worked up about it, and they wonder how the world that guy ever got to be a professor, you know, stuff like this. They get so overstimulated that they don't hear what the guy says. Another thing, a characteristic of the bad listener, is that he had great respect for the facts, and then he'd get them all jazzed up. Rather than looking for the ideas that the person is trying to give out, the good listener tries to give sense to what he's trying to do, even though rather than to just sticking with the facts, to write down all these dates, you know, that something happened this time and that time, or that a human ear listens to 16 or 80 decibels, and human voice is usually 60 decibels or something like this, rather than to try to get a concept. Another characteristic of the bad listener, he tries to make an outline. He's so involved in his outline, you know, and I watched him. Huh? I did it myself, you know. Boy, I had neat notes, huh? correct spacing here, correct spacing over here, you know.
Really great notes, sir.
And then if you go back to them after a while and try to make sense out of them, it's awful. I'm not saying you shouldn't keep notes. Mm-hmm. I think you should, but you should wait a little bit with, I mean, I think note-taking, I think you give the professor too much credit that he is following an outline. I mean, or he may be rambling, and you try to structure something that really doesn't have the structure that you're trying to impinge upon him. You should wait a few minutes and see what are the principles or the facts he's trying to get at. Sometimes this is easier said than done. Another thing that the bad listener was doing was faking attention. He really worked at trying to give the appearance he was listening. You know, he's sitting up here, boy, really looking the guy in the eye, and boy, he was probably 50 miles away, you know. He was wasting all his energy and tension on trying to convince him that he was listening. Another thing that the bad listener did was to tolerate bad performance. This is one thing I tell my students. Boy, if you want to hear me and you can't, usually that isn't the trouble. But if you can't hear me, I mean, start waving. Just don't say, if you can't hear me, just raise your hand, you know. Because they're going to wave your hand, because you know what happens? Somebody raises their hand, you see, and lets it down. So then he starts talking louder for about that long, you know, and the hand goes down, and then he's back down here, you see. Or you can't see a chart. I sat in a class this last year in a course in which I was involved. Some of these professors, I mean, they show a chart up there. I couldn't begin to see what he was trying to portray. You couldn't read any of the printing or anything. The student should say, for Pete's sake, or worse. I mean, don't show us that, or else give us something we can read. The way I do it, I mean, all the charts that are significant, I give them, pass it out to them so they can read it right in front of them, because too many students, they waste their time being secretaries instead of really listening. Excuse me for getting all worked up here. I'm getting overstimulated. But this is very aggravating to the listeners. Now, the other characteristic that he noted about this, he checked their sort of their TV listening. Now, this has been lost on me because I don't watch TV, but to an extent. But he found out that the bad listener always watched Bob Hope, Red Skelton, and the Lone Ranger. I mean, this was the level at which he was sort of categorized, you see. I mean, The Invitation to Learning, or You Are There. I don't know any of these programs. But I mean, there are some, I think, some weighty programs, aren't there? I mean, and if the person listened to those, maybe College Bowl, I don't know. Is College Bowl any good? Some of these, those that were listening to these were good listeners. These other people, they have never really experienced really painstaking listening, you see? I mean, they'd say, boy, I can't dig this stuff. I mean, two sentences, boy, I can't dig that stuff. I mean, they have never really been able to concentrate on painstaking listening. They have not been exposed to high technical listening, so they have really never learned it. Another thing that the bad listener did, he let emotional words throw them. I think probably almost everybody can be thrown by emotional words, like landlord, mother-in-law, sex, Vietnam, wife, Harry Truman, I mean, or Ronald Reagan, I'm from California, clerk instead of retail sales personnel. I mean, we let these things, I think, disturb us, and then we're off. I mean, we turn it off. And then another thing, there's a great discrepancy between what we can comprehend in listening and what the usual speaking voice is. You see, I've let my voice slow down again. I wanted to keep it really at a high pitch today. Because if I speak very fastly and you're really listening, you can really comprehend much faster than I can speak. Probably some of you can probably comprehend maybe
400 or more words, you see, per minute.
But most people, I guess, maybe speak at 100. I was going to try to pitch mine at about 200 words per minute this morning, and I think you would have been able to comprehend it, you see. And what happens then when we speak very slowly? I know what I do, because this is how most people speak. And because I have my schedule is very tight, and I have so many things to do. I have to appear at seminars. On many seminars, because sometimes my students are presenting or as a subject that I have some interest in. I go there, but I always go there with some notebooks or some letters. And I have developed a facility. I don't know how good it is, right? Because they've never tested me on a seminar that have been given, you see. But I can, I tune in about 10 seconds, and then I'm gone for 90 or something, you know. I mean, I'll try to get these points, and something will strike me, and I'll make a note of it. And then I'm back checking on something else. Here I'm writing a letter. And what I'm doing is what many people are doing, but they're not writing anything down. I mean, they'll just tune a following for a little while, and then they tune them out again. You tune in and out. Because, and I think maybe we will eventually go to speaking more fast, speaking more rapidly. And it would be interesting, maybe, to train some people to speak very fast and to test this out among some students and see, well, if you talk very rapidly. Now, this wouldn't work for some subjects, but it might work for some others. And just to see what happens. I don't know of any work in this. Now, what does Dr. Nichols say? He's no god, but he suggests this, that one of the ways for the student to perform is to anticipate the next point that the speaker might obtain. See, this keeps him alert. And if he anticipates correctly, you see, he's had two exposures to it. Or if he misses, then he has a comparison. And this is also probably a retention technique. So you learn by contrast. Another thing he says is to try to identify the building blocks that are being used, the evidence. I always try to have my students, remember the X, Y axis you see on a certain situation. And this does work in some science. The other thing is that because people do talk rather slowly, there is time for mental recapitulation. As Paul is giving you in the economics. I mean, if you progress down here, just go back a paragraph or two and say, now, this folds into this nicely. And this, I think, will help on retention. Now we go to another dimension because we're getting late. And there was a person named Godfrey, John Godfrey. He was an immigrant. He was a lawyer. He didn't really want to be a lawyer, so he wasn't a real good lawyer. But he played the stock market and he made a lot of money. He married. He had no children. His wife died fairly early. He was a very quiet guy. He really wanted to be a poet. He studied electronics on the side. He bought 4 acres at the outskirts of this town. The town grew around it, but he still kept his 4 acres. I mean, he could have sold it for a big wad of dough, but he still kept his 4 acres. He got to be 80 years old. And then he called some architects in, and he says, this is what I want you to build. And so they built this thing. It consisted of 2 rooms. And it was a very beautiful structure. And it was surrounded by beautiful flowers and so forth, and inlaid in the, over the entrance to this very beautiful structure were these words, "The man who listens," and of course people were very curious about what was going on, and he wouldn't really tell them anything, you know. And then they put something that said, "In memory of Stella Godfrey," which was his wife. And then he thought, well, now that it's finished, we must have the people come in to view it. And the people did come in. They saw that it did, in fact, consist of 2 rooms. One was larger than the other. The outer room was very restful. And then it was a note there on the inside the first room that says, "For requests to be heard." And this door would automatically open after 10 minutes. And so this is how it was structured, you see. So they went into the next room. And at the... at the side of the alcove in the second room was a brass plate, and it says, "If you wish to see the man who has listened to you," and I should say in this room too, was a high marble chair with some cushions on it. You could sit down, and this man would listen. If you wish to see the man who listened to you, touch the button above, and you will see his face. He will be glad if you thank him. But it is not necessary. And, of course, people were, of course, wondering, who is in there? You know? Can't we press the button? He says, don't press the button. Well, the truth of the matter on this button was that there was some truth in it, that it was the voices of the desperate which operated some kind of electrical impulse that opened the curtain after they'd finished their confidences and had touched the button. And that the button would not open the curtains for those who were only curious or had false intentions. And I was reminded of what is recorded in the Psalms. The Lord is near to all who call upon him, and to all who call upon him in truth. So I think Godfrey probably, maybe he'd read this. Now, the people asked Godfrey about this, why he had gone to this trouble, you know, what he expected to get from this. And he said that one of the most terrible aspects of this world today is that nobody listens to anyone else. If you are sick or even dying, nobody listens. If you are bewildered or frightened or lost or bereaved or alone or lonely, nobody really listens. Even the clergy are hurried and harassed. They do their best and work endlessly. But time has taken on a fragmented character. It doesn't seem to have any substance any longer. Nobody has time to listen to anyone, not even those who love you and would die for you. Your parents, your children, your friends, they have no time. That's a very terrible thing, isn't it? Whose fault is it? I don't know. But there doesn't seem to be any time. Now, who is Godfrey? Godfrey is a figment of the imagination of Taylor Caldwell in The Listener. But I think of what he says here is in fact true. I think it's very true. We don't take time, yet I know some of the most rewarding times to me, my children say, well, I never listen to them, but when I have three children, my most rewarding times is when I've been with them alone, you're going somewhere or something, and then they start talking to you, and you listen. These have been most rewarding to me. And now my wife and I are in the habit. Every night, we haven't done it here, but about every night, unless it's really raining hard, we go out for a walk at night and a run. We also jog, you know, keep in shape a bit, you know. But we talk. I mean, this is a most rewarding time to hash over all the great issues. And I have been impressed that, and I haven't done it admittedly enough, but, and I think you probably found this too, that people have surprised you with thanks, with appreciation, and I think genuine appreciation. And surprisingly, I mean, all you can remember is that, well, you did listen to them, but they expressed this great appreciation that you had listened to them. You had listened to them. Now, there are many statements or stories that we can listen to that are undisturbing. They will leave me and you in peace. If you tell me that NaCl is salt, so what's new, or I hear it, but it leaves me in peace. There are a lot of other things, like if Napoleon was knocked out at Waterloo, I mean, this sort of, it doesn't really do much for me either. If you say Columbus discovered America, now that will really throw me, because I'm a Norwegian, and I know Leif Erikson did. But for most of you, maybe that will leave you also in peace. But my life is really undamaged by such statements.
as any seal of salt.
But there are other things that people can tell you or can say. Like we can go back a year ago when Werner was courting Judy. Maybe it was maybe a year ago. I don't know how long ago this might have happened, but probably one evening, looking over that way when the moon was just going over Buckskin. I don't know if you've ever seen this, but some of you might have. Werner probably said to Judy, "I love you." Now, Judy couldn't take that like NaCl as salt. I mean, this must have disturbed her.
She took it with a grain of NaCl.
She probably did. She probably did.
She did not.
But she couldn't just say, "Well, thank you, Werner," and go off to bed and just hit the sack and go off. I mean, one cannot receive this passively. One has to respond to it, as is probably happening now in this village in many, many instances. See, they're not here, so I might say, I mean, maybe with Dan and Karn. I mean, you see, and Karn could not, or Judy could not respond. I mean, she has to respond to this. And God's call to us is like that. The old story of Jesus and his love is like that. We cannot listen to the words that I think are done so well by Dorothy Sayers in Creed and Chaos. She says that Jesus bar Joseph, the carpenter of Nazareth, was in fact and in truth and in the most exact and literal sense of the world, of the word, the God by whom all things were made. His body and brain were those of common man. His personality was the personality of God, so far as that personality could be expressed in human terms. He was not a kind of demon pretending to be a human. He was in every respect a genuine living man. He was not merely a man so good as to be like God. He was God. Is this story dull? It is to many people. But it certainly wasn't to those who crucified him. In fact, they crucified him because instead of accusing him of being a bore, they thought him too dynamic to be safe. We cannot face the cross where Christ died to forgive our sins so that we can obtain sonship. We cannot hear this story and do nothing. We have to be like Judy, and we must respond. We must either escape the tormenting reach of the story, in the words of Al Rognes, the tormenting reach of the story, by rejecting it, or be caught up in the wonderment of it all, in the sheer wonder of his love. And we must become involved in this one vocation, which Paul told us about, and which Howie so well explained to us this morning. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. He that cometh unto me, I will in no wise cast out. These were his words. He meant them. He died for them, and he deserves to be given a chance. So much.